Welcome to the Competent Pastor Podcast.
A podcast by pastors for pastors that starts with one question.
What is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
We're your hosts. I'm Michael Danner.
And I'm Rachel Ringenberg-Miller.
Today we're excited to talk to Rod Stafford. Rod has served as the lead pastor at Portland Mennonite Church since 1999. He went to seminary not planning to be a Mennonite or a minister, but the Spirit works in its own way. Rod grew up in the Central Valley of California, went to Berkeley, where he graduated with a degree in political science, and earned a Master of Divinity degree at Fuller Theological Seminary. He has also served MCUSA churches in Pasadena, California, and Lawrence, Kansas. Rod and his wife Molly have two daughters, Julia and Laura, and live in Northeast Portland. Rod likes to ride his bikes, eat good food, hike in the mountains, and do the Sunday crossword with Molly.
Welcome, Rod.
Glad to be with you.
So before we get into our question, I'd like to hear from you. How did you end up in congregational ministry, and how long have you been doing this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've been doing this for almost 35 years now. So I'm coming up on retirement. I didn't grow up going to a Mennonite church. I didn't really plan to be a pastor. I didn't know what a Mennonite was, for that matter. But there came a point in my 20s where I was trying to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do with life. I wanted to do something that was meaningful, something that was connected to my faith. I'd always gone to church and been part of a campus ministry. So I went to seminary. Mostly just to kind of think through my faith and where it might take me. I ended up at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena for not any particular reason other than it was evangelical, and I'd grown up in that kind of setting. And back then, the word meant something different than it means in a political context, and it meant something better back then. And while I was there, I met a couple guys. I was volunteering at an after-school tutoring program. I met a couple guys who turned out were Mennonite missionaries. They were home on furlough studying. One was Gordon Clausen, and one was Tegan Tagliata, who I still see at conventions and whatever. And they, after we talked for a while, they said, you should come to this Mennonite church. And it turned out to be, it was Pasadena Mennonite Fellowship. I think it was less than a year old. Jim Brenneman went on to be president of Goshen, was the kind of first pastor there. And it resonated for me. And then, you know, I'd signed up to do an MDiv where I went to church growing up. Nobody went to seminary. I didn't go to seminary. I guess you sign up for an MDiv. I don't know. It turned out I had to do an internship. And Jim was kind enough to let me work for him for free. And it turned out, I enjoyed it. It was meaningful for people. I learned they would pay me to do this. So I didn't go to seminary to be a pastor or a Mennonite, but the Spirit blows where it will, I guess. So I was part-time there in Pasadena, and then we went to Lawrence, Kansas for 7 years. And then I've been here in Portland for 25. So, yeah.
Well, let's jump into the question you're here for, all right? What, in your opinion...
Uh-huh. Okay.
With all your experience, what is the most important skill of a competent pastor?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that question. I mean, there are so many skills involved in being a pastor. I often feel like I'm a jack of all trades. And I like that because it just keeps the job interesting. And, you know, there's a lot to learn along the way. I'm not sure I've mastered very many of them, but it requires a lot of skills. Which is the most important? What's most important in pastoral ministry is not that much, it's not so much a skill. I mean, it's just trust. People have to trust us. They have to trust us morally and ethically, obviously. They have to trust that it is us, that we're authentic. I mean, preaching is the most public thing we do. When people look up there, they have to trust that that's really me up there, that what I'm talking about matters to me, that I'm engaged, that I'm the same guy up there that I am at home and, you know, in the office and during the week and when we play racquetball or pickleball or whatever. And they do have to just trust our competence that, you know, we'll show up to meetings on time, we'll be prepared, that they can be pretty vulnerable with us and we won't be talking out of turn. So I'm not sure that's really a skill, but obviously that's what's most important. I don't know. I keep talking. I mean, there are, you know, we do have these competencies, core competencies that the denominations identified. And I don't know, asking which of those is most important is like asking which of your kids do you love the most. I mean, they're all pretty important. I was thinking, you know, when I looked over these again, in some ways, I think you could be competent at all of these. And I'm not sure you still might not be a competent pastor. In the sense of they're necessary, but I'm not sure they're sufficient. What I was thinking about is I have two daughters, and when they were getting close to turning 16, I taught them how to drive, and we went out to this parking lot. There's a lot of industrial area north of town. There's nobody there on the weekend, so the parking lot's big and empty. And the first thing they had to do is just learn how to operate the car. I mean, like, remember which is the brake and which is the gas and how do the mirrors work and turning. I mean, that was just a circus, but that's not really driving. Like, you have to know how to operate the machine, but that's not driving. Cause when you're driving, that has to be second nature in a sense. You have to know where you're trying to get, how to get there. You have to be attentive to what's around you. And some of that, I think when I looked at these, I thought it's sort of the same thing. Like, you have to be able to do these things. But to be a pastor, you also more so have to be attentive to where you're trying to go, how you're trying to, as a congregation, get there, what's going on around. So, and again, I'm not sure it's a skill necessarily, but I would say just attentiveness is a key skill to pastoring. I mean, there's that kind of spiritual dimension of attentiveness, of being attentive to the wisdom of the scriptures, of listening to the Spirit, particularly, you know, I mean, when we're preparing sermons, there's kind of pastoral attentiveness, just paying attention to the people in the congregation. And I think until COVID and, you know, we had to be distanced and away from each other, I hadn't fully understood how much information one could gather on a Sunday morning. I mean, there might be 200 people, and obviously you can't talk to everyone, but just watching who's there, who's not there, how they're interacting, who's interacting with who, and just little moments of contact even that assure people, you know, I see them. So there's that kind of attentiveness, but then there's sort of the, I mean, there's the practical attentiveness. We get paid to do this. We get 40 or 50 hours a week. There's a lot of really committed volunteers, and they really have their own jobs and families. And so there's stuff that I think it's our job to notice. Even like in the summer, realizing like, yeah, we should probably start the budgeting process here pretty soon. I bet the treasurer would eventually remember that, but it might be a little later in the process. So stuff like that. And then I think there's just paying attention on the leadership side. Where are we in that kind of cycle of an institution? Where are we going? Well, part of it's just, you know, where are the pinch points? Where's the anxiety? What are the questions that need to be asked? What are the conflicts that are coming up, and how are we going to address those in healthy ways? So I don't know. I would say attentiveness. How about that? It's not one of the core competencies mentioned here, but.
Yeah, well, the attentiveness got me thinking. So you've been, you know, pastoring for a long time, and so has this always seemed like an important skill to you, or when or at what point were you like, this is a thing that, well, I ought to start paying attention to?
You know, it sounds weird, but when I was in Lawrence, it was a smaller church. It was maybe 60 people. We had 90 people on Easter one year, and that was just like, man, we felt like we were a mega church at that point.
Revival.
Yeah. Yeah. 50% increase. How about that? I became a pastor. I don't think I realized that pastors were leaders and expected to be leaders. Like, obviously I knew about preaching and you get up front and people listen to you. But it took me a while to, in a small church, it's not like you necessarily feel like a leader. You feel more like a servant, because if there's going to be a bulletin in that church, it's because I was going to make it up and I was going to take it home and get my daughters to help me fold it on Saturday night. And we were meeting in an ecumenical Christian ministry center, and they had stuff on Friday nights and Saturday nights. So I get there on Sunday early and usually I had to clean up after it. And then I had to set up chairs. For new pastors, never underestimate the amount of furniture moving that's involved in pastoral ministry. It's a shocking amount of tables and chairs and everything else.
Amen. So, and I'll say I was going to interrupt you and say maybe that's why when I worked at Port Lemon and I was always the one doing chairs, because you were out. You decided you were done with the chairs.
I don't remember quite that way.
All these young.
I developed some canny skills over time. So
I think of these young whippersnappers that have these PVC tables that are really light. Like I used to have to lug around the particle board tables with steel legs. That's like a workout.
Yeah. That's a workout. Yeah, and churches tend not to get rid of stuff. We had some tables here. They just had sharp edges on them, metal edges. Yeah.
Get a tetanus shot every time there's a youth event.
Yeah. But I think the point was, I didn't feel like I felt like a servant more than anything, but pastors are leaders. And I think I realized I'm going to have to figure out how to do this. I'm not a natural leader. Both, that kind of institutional leadership, but part of it is you're a leader just by virtue of the position, and you shape in a lot of ways, just even passively, kind of the culture of a church, because people look at you, they see how you're doing stuff, and that becomes sort of the norm in the culture of a congregation, I think. So it's kind of, anyway, I guess that's the point at which I realized, oh, I should be paying more attention here, be more deliberate, be more intentional. So yeah, that's a good question.
What's interesting to me, so just to go back to the first thing you said, it was trust, or what I would even think about trustworthiness, how everything you're talking about happens in the context of being a trustworthy leader. Even as you talk about once I realized it was leadership, I had to study to do it. Because why? Well, because you wanted to be competent at it and you wanted people to be able to trust you. Mm-hmm. So this diversity of skills you're talking about, I think that's right. That's why we even talk about the competent pastor. I mean, there's so many things you do. You can't be excellent at all of them. But what's kind of an overarching skill that you have that holds all that stuff together? And you sound like a trustworthy pastor to me. So that's interesting that you pulled that out. This is the thing or the glue or the dark matter that holds the rest of this universe together. Am I a trustworthy person? Can they trust me? Am I authentic? Mm-hmm. Am I a good model? Yeah. And then mm-hmm. how does that impact the culture of the whole church, so that even the witness of the church and the community becomes something that's trustworthy? That's... Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's what I'm hearing. That's pretty cool, I think.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, and I think, and along those lines, as you were talking, Rod, I was thinking about how there's a difference between the two churches that, or three churches, that you've pastored at. And so you were at a small church, and then you were at a larger church that experienced growth. And so I'm wondering, what did that attentiveness look like at both locations? Because I would imagine at a small church, you're kind of thinking about certain things that maybe you wouldn't think about at a larger church, or maybe I'm wrong. I'm just curious if things shifted for you in your pastoral transitions.
Yeah. I think, that first congregation in Pasadena, it was a newer church. I was part-time. It was just keep this thing rolling. The Lord's Church was newer. It was around for 12 or 15 years, maybe, but it was also at the stage where they needed to kind of develop organizationally, which I was pretty good. I mean, we wrote bylaws or whatever, a constitution at that point, and just kind of figured out some practices that were going to help that congregation settle in sustainable ways. Yeah, Portland was a different church. It's bigger, it was a little more traditional. They deferred to their pastor a lot more. The first two churches, these were my friends, I was their age. Here they deferred to me, and I had an administrator. It was sweet. She was very loyal. It was Kathy Harder. Yeah. I love Kathy.
So do I.
I love the sort of loyalty. She was watching out for me. It was great. But it is, it's just a kind of a bigger organization. And so I think figuring out how to understand the dynamics of it, more people to keep track of. And then we started adding staff. So it's just a more complex system. And what was your question? Sort of how the attentiveness is different?
Yeah, well, I was wondering, is it different? Is it different from different spaces that you've been in? Have you had to kind of like, you know, tweak it a little bit as you're going along, yeah, based upon your context?
I mean, I think in a small enough church, it is different because it, you know, in that Alban Institute language, those are more family churches. Mm-hmm. Pastors are really, mm-hmm, chaplains in those settings. You're not really a leader. And if you try to be, it's probably not going to work out well for anyone. So the smaller church it is, and in Pasadena was new. I mean, it was all hands on deck. That was really different. Yeah, it's probably more just, as you get to be a more of a medium-sized church, the things you have to be attentive to are different. I mean, when I first got here, I'd say the church was 160, really kind of a small church, single cell. Everybody knows everybody. The pastor can relate to everybody. Processes are more informal. Once you get beyond a certain size, you can't keep up with everyone. And so you have to focus a little bit, your attention a little bit different places. Still, you know, I mean, I never wanted to be the pastor of a church larger than the number of people whose names I could remember, which back then I thought would be about 350. Right now, it's significantly smaller, actually. That's why we have an online directory to help me. So you do shift the things that you pay attention to, especially kind of shifting from one size to another size, just because churches have to function differently at that point. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but
yeah, it does. Thanks.
So I'm curious. So 35 years in pastoral ministry, what has been one of the more significant changes or shifts you've noticed over that period from probably the late 80s, right, that you started up until now?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It was late 80s. I got ordained in 1991. So okay. More significant changes? Well, obviously, that, you know, the conversation about sexuality and the way the church that processed, the way this church processed that, that's a pretty significant shift. I think the pandemic, I mean, that's pretty recent, but that's really shifted things, not just in churches, but I think in the broader culture. And I'm not sure what that's going to require. I think that's part of the reason that I'm thinking it's time for me to retire, because this church is at the point where they need to be thinking some about how to shift the way they do church. It's also, there's a generational shift that's gone on here. They need somebody for the next 8 or 10 years to help process that. I'm probably not that guy, but if I was, I think it'd be a really interesting conversation. So probably just the sort of the institutionalness that people are comfortable with. There's not as much institutional loyalty probably as there was in an earlier generation, which is, I mean, it's neither here nor there. It just is. So, yeah.
So how did you get to the place of realizing you weren't that guy for the next stage? Because I think that's something that pastors are discerning along the way. When is it like, when, mm-hmm, is it their work to do? And when is it, you know, a time to say, you know what, I may not be the person to, mm-hmm, guide this process?
Yeah. I think it was different when I was in Lawrence. I was there for 7 years, and I've been on a sabbatical. When I came back, I think I just realized there's a certain cycle. You know, when I got there was things I could imagine doing, and at 7 or 8 years, either they were going to have been done, or they were dumb ideas to begin with, shouldn't have even thought of them, or they were just not going to happen. But that cycle had kind of was coming to an end. And for me, the question was, am I kind of ready to engage another 7 or 8 year cycle? And just after the sabbatical, I felt like the congregation and I were maybe not on the same track. What I didn't want to do was just go year to year. Like, do I want to do another year here or not? So I felt like I needed, in that case, to think, is this going to be good for the next cycle? And I didn't think so. And then this job came up and I felt called to come back to the West Coast. So I was really glad about that. Here, I don't know. It's a weird thing. it's like 12 years became 18 years, and now somehow it's 25 years. It never, and I think part of it was we were intentional at certain points of being sort of recognizing where we were in those kind of cycles and moving on to the next, onto the next. And there's just always stuff that was interesting. There's stuff, I think, once we started that, and especially as we came toward that decision-making on the conversation about sexuality, like not walking away now. Mm-hmm. So there's always stuff I felt was important, was interesting. I felt like this was the place for me to be. Retirement's a little different. I mean, I'm 65. So my hope was that my glide path to 65 and the glide path toward retirement would kind of match up, because it's not a job you can just stick around trying to play it out till you can collect Social Security or pension or whatever. So happily, I think those have overlapped pretty well. I mean, yeah, you know, the COVID, you can't walk away then. So I think now, though, coming out of COVID, I also wanted to finish, you know, on a strong note. I feel like we have really good staff. We got a healthy congregation. We've been doing some behind the work sort of institutional stuff to clear up some things, so whoever comes in kind of gets a good running start. So, yeah. I don't know. Someone at one point told me that before 12 years, you should ask, you know, if there's a reason to leave. After 12 years, you should ask if there's a reason to stay. I thought that's kind of interesting. I just kept staying.
I just found a yes.
Yeah.
What's that?
I said, you always found a yes to that question, a reason to stay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, 25 years is a long tenure, especially in Mennonite context. I think the average would probably be closer to 5 to 7, depending on your particular role. I was at Metamora for 18 years and then got to a point where I couldn't retire. I knew I wasn't going to hit retirement. Mm-hmm. But there's also a sense in which I probably could have stayed there, and we were all very comfortable with each other. We could have kept going mm-hmm. on that same trajectory, but I got the sense mm-hmm. I wasn't the person that could take them to where they needed to go next. And so, you know, sometimes you can be good at the role and be a good, competent pastor in a context, and yet still it's time to move on. But it's difficult to discern that. Like I've heard people say, when you've used all the tools in your toolbox, you don't have anything else to offer. It's not even necessarily that, but it probably is more spiritual discernment. But 25 years, I was going to ask you a similar question. Like, what's the secret to being at a place for 25 years? Might be being trustworthy. We'll see. But yeah, what do you think? Like, what makes it possible, or what are the kinds of things that could actually trip up a pastor in the midst of that? Like,
yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, obviously your own life of faith, your own life with Christ has to be attended to and vibrant. And so some of it's internal, personal, having healthy family relationships, healthy relationships in the congregation. I think, you know, helping lead the congregation into new life. I don't know. That sounds a little trite, but sustaining a sense of purpose in the congregation. Like my sense is that the default position in most organizations, and maybe churches especially, is maintenance. It's just the mission is to maintain, to keep doing what we've been doing, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing what we've been doing, but it's hard to sustain a vibrant congregation if your only thing you're doing is doing what you've always been doing. So that sense of purpose and mission, some intentionality, I don't know, always kept it interesting. There's always something else out there, something else we were working on. That I liked. I think, you know, a while ago I did a sabbatical. Actually, it was the first year of COVID, so it was a short one, and I got COVID in the midst of it, so it really was a sucky sabbatical, actually. But it was on long-term pastoral ministry. And what was interesting, there's not a lot of stuff that's been done, but Alban Institute wrote a book a number of years, a long time ago. It looked like it was printed on dot matrix paper. I mean, it was just that old of a book. But they went into the study, and their assumption was that long-term pastorates were a bad thing. Like the only reason people stayed in pastorates a long time is because they couldn't move up or couldn't move on. And they discovered later that's not really necessarily the case. But the danger of a long-term pastorate is that often it's people that are really good relationally. What happens is there's really good relationships, but they get to a point where the pastor doesn't want to push hard on anything because it will foul up, or the congregation doesn't want to push the pastor on stuff. And so they just sort of settle into a kind of a maintenance mode. So I think, you know, part of it here is I think the congregation's been willing to take on stuff. I mean, that sexuality conversation, Rachel was here for part of it. It was pretty rough at times. In the end, I think we came to a healthy, I'm glad for the decision we came to, and I thought we did in a pretty healthy way. But building projects along the way, now we're talking about race, anti-racism. We have stained glass windows in this church. And right behind me when I preach is a big white Jesus. And so talking about that, that's not dissimilar from talking about sex. It cuts pretty deep. And so that's been a pretty engaging and in some ways hard conversation. But it's also, that's normal. That's what churches do. We're trying to figure out how to follow the way of Jesus. And even those difficult conversations, I think, have a way of generating a kind of vibrancy, or they can, at least, if you do them sort of well. So
you might not remember this, but I actually preached at your church once, probably around maybe 2018, 2019.
I do remember. I wish I could remember exactly what you preached on, but it was very good.
I don't either.
Yeah, I remember everything you preached, Rod.
But I do remember that was a very white Jesus.
I remember
Jesus,
you lie a lot, too, so.
Oh, man. That's not a core competency of effective pastors, lying a lot.
I know, right? Oh, man.
It's a core competency, too.
That is the whitest Jesus I've ever seen in a stained glass.
Oh, that is the whitest Jesus. Yeah. Well, that story and like how the congregation's dealing with it is fascinating to me, because the way I understand it at Portland Mennonite is that there was a big balcony behind that window, mm-hmm. and that those who were in the church, Portland Mennonite Church, they bought it from another denomination. And when they did the remodel, when Rod was mm-hmm. there, all of a sudden there is this massive stained glass window. Yeah. And then with the reorientation of the sanctuary to make more room for people, then that became the focal point. So it was just interesting how it was this thing mm-hmm. like that wasn't there, mm-hmm. then it was found, and then it was like, what do we do with this thing?
Yeah, and truthfully, we didn't notice it at the time.
Sure,
this is this big window. It's Jesus knocking at the door. That's a pretty cool story.
Yeah.
It took a while to sink in or for us to notice. Mm-hmm. Which is a little, embarrassing to admit, but it also reminds me that we're all on this journey, and we can be a little bit gracious toward each other mm-hmm. when we find ourselves at different points,
yeah.
and at the same time be persistent mm-hmm. about pressing ahead on the conversation. So, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is what I'm hearing from you, too, is this the vibrancy of faith. So the way that you were able to kind of continue in this role of ministry is just like there's always something new to learn. I remember that when we were working together along with Kurt Weaver, sometimes whenever we would do something new, we would look at each other and say, what could go wrong? And then laugh because everything could go wrong. So this idea of creating new things, but in the midst of that's difficult. And so I'm wondering – there's kind of the positive side, you know, having conversations, developing faith, relationships. But, you know, was there a point or points when you were like, you know what, I'm out? And how did you discern to keep going? Because clearly that's what you decided. But what did you do in those moments of wondering, oh, my gosh, maybe this is time for me to leave?
Yeah. Honestly, I wasn't ever at a point where I was like, I think I might be done here. I don't know. I'm stubborn or I don't know. Yeah, there were points that it was difficult. Honestly, on that decision about sexuality, we had, we could talk about that for hours, but there was a point where I wrote a proposal, and it was presented to the congregation, and it was around the question of whether our pastors could marry people who were gay or lesbian. And it was meant to be, we think this is what we're hearing, the Spirit, how the Spirit's guiding our congregation. I'm not sure everybody understood the document quite that way, and some people thought I was kind of strong-arming it through or whatever. But I remember, you know, we couldn't come to consensus. In our church, you have to have an 80% approval if you go to a vote. That's a pretty high bar. Mm-hmm. I knew the congregation pretty well. I was counting votes. But there was a moment that day when the vote was going to be counted with the conference minister. I'd written two letters to the congregation, and I didn't know which one. I was pretty sure which one was going to be sent out. But I also, it occurred to me a little too late, I think. I'm up front on this. If this doesn't go through, I think I might be done, whether I want to be or not. I think I have to be done. You can't get out front and then have the tree cut out behind you. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess I didn't. Maybe I've tried to, like when you do new stuff, I try to not worry. I don't want to be afraid of failure. And I think I try to communicate. And you can do that when you try things by calling it a pilot project or putting a short term on it so that there's a chance for people to weigh in. I don't know. There was stuff I wanted to do and never happened. Stuff that I wanted to do. It took us a long time to get there. I don't know. People have been pretty kind too. They like me, I guess. So. That helps.
They do.
I'm very likable.
I mean, I think what I'm hearing from you actually goes back to what you originally said about trust, right? You're paying attention to the congregation and you're in this point of potential conflict, or you're in conflict. That was a traumatic mm-hmm. experience back then. But also that authenticity, right? So whatever happens next, this also does impact how I'm going to go, because I believe that I need to be authentic and trustworthy in this congregation. So I'm kind of hearing that part too, and like, all right, do I go or do I stay? Like, what makes mm-hmm. the most sense mm-hmm. as I understand my role yeah. in this congregation?
Yeah. I mean, part of it's obviously very personal, just how I'm right. feeling. And, you know, truthfully, I'm at the point where the tank feels empty more than it used to. Mm-hmm. Man, 25 years, I've said most things I have to say. I've preached all the sermons I ever want to preach on John the Baptist. Come on, twice every Advent season? That's ridiculous.
Still gets his head cut off.
Yeah. No judgment. I think that the other thing is there's a cumulative weariness that sets in too. I just, maybe it's because I'm getting into my 60, well, I'm 64 now, but a little bit of weariness. I just don't have the energy or the spark that I used to. And that was it. I mean, I always felt like sermons are kind of hard sometimes, but when I sat down, it was always engaging. So it still is, but I feel like for my sake and for their sake too. Yeah, the other was, so for me personally, but there's also what the congregation needs. I don't know. Maybe that sounds kind of arrogant. I thought they needed me. So.
Well, they didn't kick you out after That's your right. reviews, right? You
have they, did, they still seem happy. Most people want me to stay a little bit longer.
So you've been there 25 years, so you've got to be doing something right.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? I think, it's also true that after a certain period of time, like if people didn't like me, they left a long time ago. Yeah. The people that come now, this is how it goes around here, so whatever. Mm-hmm. What kind do of you build in a little bulletproofness, I guess.
What do you anticipate missing the most?
I mean, this is my primary community. Being a pastor is such a weird job. Mm-hmm. This is my primary community. This is a source of a lot of friendships in my life. So for a year at least, I need to step away from that. So some of those, just that sense of community. I think pastors, we get to be in the middle of the life of a congregation that's trying to figure out how to be faithful. I mean, that's really cool. There's also just there's those privileged moments of being with people at the most important moments of their lives. Sometimes those are really hard moments, but those are really sacred moments. So I'll miss that. I'll miss preaching I love to preach. I love not to preach because it's you know, you've done it. It's hard. But I don't know. When you're up front, you tell a joke and everyone laughs. That's pretty cool. I mean, okay, there's the proclaiming the gospel, the biggest problem with that, of
Minor
course.
detail, the good news.
There's a certain amount of performing, or there's those I mean, where else in life do you get 20 minutes to talk to 100, 200 people and they listen? And, you know, there's those moments when you tell a story or you tell, it's usually telling a story and you realize that it is completely quiet. Like you have everyone, even the kids realize their parents are watching. Oh, that's so cool. I'll miss that.
Well, it's cool and a little creepy, I find, right? Because all of, like, I know that when I've been in those moments, I'm like, oh my gosh, everybody's really listening to me right now.
Yeah,
I better bring this home.
I know it's a powerful moment. You realize, wow, I'm not sure I'm worthy of this, but whatever. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, another question I have too is just thinking about, okay, the longevity of this of your role, but then thinking about new pastors, like what advice would you give to them? Or said another way, what is some advice you wish someone would have given to you?
Well, you know, be trustworthy, pay attention, all that kind of stuff.
And
Being a pastor is a, it's a very it's a I think it's a unique job. There's no other job that's like it. It's public, it's professional, it's also very personal, even private. It's our job, it's also our community. I mean, nobody really tells us how to do it. I mean, there's a million ways to be a pastor. There's as many ways of being a pastor as there are pastors. And so you kind of have to figure out your own way. But from day to day, people don't usually tell us what to do. And there's a million things that we could do. And if we did all million, we'd have a million more, because until the kingdom comes, there's more to do. So you got to kind of figure out how you're going to do it in a healthy way. Part of that is you know, there might be 100 things you should do in a week. There's about 12 you actually can do. So I find it takes an astonishing amount of time to not do things. Like on Mondays, I always sit down and just think through my week. And it takes me a long time to realize it. Mostly I'm figuring out what I'm not going to do, because then I can figure out what I have time to do. So it's, you know, it's figuring out how you're going to prioritize, how you're going to set some boundaries. Nobody's going to say no for us. And there's also very few kind of quantifiable ways to find affirmation. So you got to figure out how to figure out your own affirmation. I mean, people say nice things after sermons. Mostly they're being polite. I did a wedding once. It was an outdoor wedding. I always remember this. It's an outdoor wedding. Didn't have a sound system, and it was I could tell very quickly that only the people in the first three rows could hear me. There were like 30 rows. There were so many people in the back. Nobody could hear me. So after the service, somebody comes up, and I know he was sitting in the back, and he goes, "Hey, that was a really good sermon." Like, you didn't hear a word I said. I mean, I appreciate the compliment, but it makes me question everything you tell me in the future. So people say nice things, but you know, we get reviews and accountability and whatever. But for the most part, you got to kind of figure out how you're going to do it in a way that is going to be sustainable, the way that's going to be healthy for you, for the church, for your family. So, yeah.
I just like to ask people when they say that was a great sermon. I usually would say, "What part did you like the best?" Just to catch, especially if I saw him sleeping through most of it. What was your favorite part?
Yeah, or people come up a week or two later and they'll say, "Well, last week when you said," I'm like, "I have no idea what last week's sermon was." So, and usually I don't remember saying whatever they thought I said. So,
right.
And sometimes you didn't.
Yeah, you didn't say the thing. You're like, "Well, I
I
guess that's your
know. I'm pretty
interpretation."
sure. Yeah, I'm like, I don't know where you got that, but I wish I'd said it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think what I liked or kind of keyed on as you're talking about what would you know, the advice you'd give to new pastors, that there are things that you are able to do and things that you just aren't able to do, and kind of being able to be okay with saying, you know what, I don't have time to do thus and so because of whatever else is happening. I think that prioritization is a it's a high learning curve.
Yeah. And what's a crisis for someone might not be a crisis for me.
Right. Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. And what's urgent may not be what the priority is either. Mm-hmm. So that can be a little tricky in a congregation because, you know, people have their own expectations. I think the other thing that is helpful for me, I read this a long time ago, but thinking about the longer term and getting stuff done, they said that we overestimate what we can do in 1 year and we underestimate what we can get done in 5 years. So that sense of being patient, but also being persistent. I mean, churches move slowly. Mm-hmm. Drives business people crazy. I mean, we used to have a managing partner for Bob's Red Mill. I mean, if he had an idea on Monday, he'd go in and his staff would have it ready to implement by Tuesday. He's like, he'd have an idea for me. He's like, well, that committee's going to meet next week. And then the table is going to meet in 2 weeks. They could give some money and then we'll have a congregational meeting about it. So get back to me in 6 months. And, he's like, anyway, churches are slow. Mm-hmm. But being patient, being persistent, I think is a helpful way to.
Well, I think my question to wrap it up would be, we talked about what would you say to new pastors, but what would you say to a pastor who is trying to decide whether or not they should leave pastoral ministry or not? Not that you're convincing them to stay, but, you know, in terms of your experience and the things that you've worked through, what would you tell someone who's trying to discern whether or not to leave pastoral ministry?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. That might be the same question, you know, it might be the same answer for someone who's wondering whether they should go into pastoral ministry.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, first year I went to seminary. I went to a seminary that I just picked off a map. I had no idea. And the first week that I was there, I knew it was the wrong seminary, but I'd already paid the tuition. But they had a chapel service, and there was a guy who got up, and his little talk was like 10 things I wish somebody told me when I was in seminary. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember the other nine, but he basically said, if you can do something else, do it. I mean, being a pastor is, it's kind of a hard job. You don't get paid all that much relative to other careers. But I think for me, that was my sense of calling. I just didn't think there was anything else I was going to be able to do that was going to be as satisfying or meaningful. It's kind of that line from Jeremiah. Like I said, I didn't grow up thinking I wanted to be a pastor. I'm pretty sure I did not want to be a pastor, actually. But there's that line in Jeremiah where he says it's like a fire in my bones and I had to let it out. I think that's how I've always felt about being a pastor. There's something in me, and being a pastor is the way that I can let it out. You know, often through preaching, but in other ways as well. So I don't know. So do you still have that fire in your bones or not? And if you don't, that's okay. I mean, there's lots of other ways to be a Christian. There's lots of other ways to be in ministry. I mean, we all are, wherever we find ourselves. So I don't know. Do you have that fire in your bones? If not, there's plenty of other things that one can do. So, yeah.
Yeah, I like that imagery. And I think it just kind of speaks to, like, this is something that people are called to, and discerning on what that looks like for you takes, well, as you, the words that you were using, patient and persistence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you, Rod, for this conversation. Appreciate you taking the time and working with us across time zones. I think we got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for asking.